Okay, welcome back. For those of you who have been following the outrageous trial of Ernst Zundel, I hate to use the word trial. It's a sham. It's a joke. It's a farce. It's a grave insult to the wonderful history of Europe, European justice, Germany, German justice, and an entire culture of Germany, which, as we now know, was earmarked for elimination early in the last century, World War I, followed by World War II. We know now that Churchill and Stalin had an agreement in 1938 that a war would be waged, a war not to defeat Germany, but a war to defeat and destroy the German nation and its people. Hitler was, according to several fascinating documents, set up to actually invade and expand militarily so Germany could be crushed by overwhelming forces from the East and the West, which is exactly what happened. There is an awful lot more to World War II history than we know. We are learning more all the time, and there are people on this planet who care about bringing history into accord with reality and the facts of the past. They are called historical revisionists. They are scholars, they are writers, they are researchers. There are some pretty remarkable people who have to fight some overwhelming odds. One man who has done a great deal to roll back the shadows and the mists of obfuscation of World War II and other important periods of our last history is my guest now for this hour, Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review. Mark is going to bring us up to date on the, can't use that word trial, on the sham legal proceedings being waged against Ernst Zundel in Germany, and others apparently to follow. We know that Germar Rudolph has been arrested now, another revisionist, a Max Planck scholar, no less, scientist, a brilliant man, and David Irving, certainly one of the most gifted historians of our times, has recently been arrested in Austria. So there's a big move afoot to try to quash dissent in an historical sense, dissent, and it is being played out right in front of us. So let's find out what's new from Mark Weber. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Jeff. Thank you very much for that generous introduction.
Well, I try to sum it up as best I can. And there's a lot going on that we just, as a general populace, don't know about, but when you discover the truth and find these documents and find out what was really going on back half a century or more ago, it's mind-boggling, but you know, you're not allowed to talk about some of these things, and if you do, you'll end up in a courtroom in Germany or other places as well, or you'll spend 3 years of your life in jail, like Mr. Zundel does, and hopefully there may be some resolution to this. By the way, for those of you who have been following the case, look at the bottom corner of our featured story section at the top of Rents.com for the permanent featured story about Ernst Zundel and his struggles. Go ahead, Mark. Tell us what's going on.
Well, thanks a lot, Jeff. Yes, the section you have on Ernst Zundel is very good, and we have a link to that section on our own site. There's, of course, a great deal about the Zundel ordeal and the ordeal of many others who have challenged the oppressive laws in Europe that ban so-called Holocaust denial on our website and also on the Zundelsite.org.
You know, it's not just dealing with the Holocaust. It's really an issue that stretches even beyond that. So let's proceed. I think some of you listening are going to be amazed at what passes now for justice and the legal process in Germany. It's mind-boggling. Go ahead.
Right. Well, a lot's happened just in the last few weeks, Jeff. As you know, the first day of the Zundel trial was on November 8th, and it ended in a huge uproar with the judge saying that the lead defense attorney was dismissed, and another attorney that they wanted to bring in as part of the defense team, he would not be permitted to participate. The defense attorneys made a motion that the judge recuse himself because of his own bias. The judge also threatened, and the prosecutor threatened, that if the defense attorneys proceeded with the case as they were planning, they would be charged themselves for, again, as violators of the so-called Holocaust denial law.
In other words, what they're saying is they would not be allowed to present any evidence at all that would cross this absurd line of what can and can't be talked about.
Right. So the defense attorney made their own ploy of saying, all right, Mr. Judge, if we can't present the evidence in court, in a public court, because it would be a violation of the law, we ask for a closed trial, a secret trial, to present the evidence. And, of course, the judge turned that down. After a week, the judge decided on his own that he wasn't really biased, so he would proceed. But there's a kind of a bind here with the whole trial, because the judge now has to decide who's going to be the defense attorney. By German law, the defense attorney has to be someone that the defendant has some confidence in.
Right.
But on the other hand, if it's an attorney that Darren Zindel has confidence in, then he'll be someone who's going to fight really strongly for his client.
Of course.
The case has gotten a tremendous amount of attention. But just 3 days after the dramatic opening day of the Zindel trial in Mannheim, David Irving was arrested in Austria, get this, on the basis of a statement he made of a charge 16 years old, merely for saying something that's a violation of that country's so-called Holocaust denial, an arrest warrant from 1989. And he's been held now from the 11th of November, when he was arrested in Austria, to the present. And the Austrian authorities are deciding whether they're going to press charges which could keep him in jail for 20 years. It's absolutely astonishing. Now, the arrest of David Irving has gotten quite a lot of international attention, because Irving is the author of more than 30 books of 20th century history, including several very highly acclaimed books and several best-selling books published by major publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's been denounced by a lot of people for the views that he has expressed, but there's no question that Irving is a historian of world-class stature, and so the case has gotten a lot of attention. But it shouldn't be forgotten that David Irving is not at all alone in this regard. These bizarre laws that restrict only this one chapter of history, that's an important aspect of that. These are selective laws that criminalize disputing the official story only of this one chapter of history. That is the official story of the wartime treatment and fate of Europe's Jews during the Second World War. But among the others over the years who have been fined, imprisoned, or forced into exile for so-called Holocaust denial include French professor Robert Forestone in France, a well-known French academic Roger Garaudy in France, a Belgian activist named Siegfried Verbeke, who was just deported from Belgium to Germany as well, Jürgen Graf, who was an educator in Switzerland, Augustin Armand Amadrus in Switzerland, and in Germany, even the largest number, including a man named Günther Deckert, who was arrested and imprisoned for several years merely for serving as the interpreter of a speech by the American Fred Lucher.
Several years of his life.
Yes. These are all astonishing developments around a bizarre law that flies in the face of all the ancient, venerable, and universal standards of justice. One of the most remarkable features of this, which can't be emphasized strongly enough, Jeff, is that even truthful and factual statements are illegal under the basis of these laws if they serve, in the views of the authorities, to whitewash or downplay the Holocaust, that is, the suffering of Europe's Jews, even if they're true, even if they're truthful statements.
Mm-hmm.
This
mm-hmm.
is a fantastic perversion of the normal standards of justice. Now, to keep it in some perspective, these laws do not exist in all European countries. They exist in about 9 or 10 European countries and in Israel. Now, Israel also has a law, interestingly enough, that makes denying God a crime. But the punishment for denying God in Israel is 1 year imprisonment. The punishment for denying the Holocaust in Israel is 5 years imprisonment. It shows you something about the kind of standards of values in that society. Now,
correct.
In American society, in Europe, mm-hmm. European society, laws used to exist making a blasphemy or denial of God a crime. Those laws, of course, have long since been done away with. But in 9 European countries, it's a crime to, quote, deny the Holocaust. And if such laws existed in with regard to any other chapter of history in any other country, the American media would not only be denouncing them, they would be holding them up to ridicule, the
Correct.
Ridicule that they deserve. But these laws, these selective and one-sided laws, are used to oppress, fine, imprison, and force into exile many different victims.
Amazing. We should also, very quickly, but for the record, further define Holocaust denial doesn't mean people are denying it happened.
Right.
They're trying to ask for a revised view or an honest scientific inquiry, an intellectual, scholarly, academic inquiry into what really did happen. That request, that call for a true investigation is, in and of itself, called Holocaust denial. It's intellectually almost beyond belief that these kinds of things are being argued and actually passed into law in this century. Bizarre. Utterly. Mark Weber. You know, it is interesting that what we were talking about on the way out, that even to ask for an investigation of what really happened is grounds for people to be arrested. This is really, really cuckoo.
Well, I want to mention something, Jeff. Over the years, I know this is not familiar maybe to some, especially younger listeners, but over the years, what we call the Holocaust or the Holocaust story has changed a great deal. Now, we often think that something called the Holocaust is like set in stone, it's inarguable, it's been proven, and that's the end of the story.
It's almost like a section out of the Bible.
Right, right. Something just set in stone.
Well, it's inviolate, right.
Completely untrue, completely inaccurate. The Holocaust story has been twisted and changed tremendously over the years, both with all sorts of specifics, with numbers, places, and so forth.
Well, look at that. Let's take Auschwitz. The original cast-in-stone claim was that 4 million perished there.
Right.
Is it horrible?
Right.
But where is it now? It's officially down to one or less, isn't it?
It's less than that, yes. The most recent estimates given of a kind of an official nature say, well, hundreds of thousands of people died, perhaps of gassing. There was a lengthy article in a scholarly German magazine about a couple of years ago on this very subject, and the author of this article went so far as to say, well, the evidence suggests that there wasn't any killing of Jews even at Auschwitz, even at Birkenau, as part of an extermination policy. Now, in fact, some of those who have protested against the Holocaust denial laws asked the public prosecutor to have this man prosecuted as well. His name was Fritjof Meyer, who's a very prominent figure in German journalism and scholarship.
I remember this story now.
Right, right. But even though he had made these statements, the authorities did not prosecute him, probably because he's so prominent. They have, of course, continued the prosecution of people who are much less defenseless. But the point is that Fritjof Meyer and others have brought the figures much, much down, even at Auschwitz, the central place. Now, the dogma, the notion that 4 million people were systematically killed in gas chambers at Auschwitz, wasn't just some assertion, some estimate. It was supposedly codified by the Nuremberg trial in 1945-1946 on the basis of an official investigation. Well, this official investigation was carried out by none other than the Soviet Union. But that was the official story for years, and you can find on our website and many other sources how that 4 million figure was repeated over and over and over again in the West, in America, in Europe, and so forth, and had this dogmatic aspect of it.
And we know now that it was a clear fabrication of Uncle Joe, Stalin, and the Soviet machine, which sought to continue to focus world attention on the Holocaust and Germany while they were busy taking over and solidifying their stranglehold on all of Eastern Europe.
Right.
Great misdirection. Guy wasn't stupid.
Well, listeners of the show, if they click onto our website, www.ihr.org, and go to the leaflet section, we'll find a number of very easy-to-read, fairly short essays which give a good introduction to this whole issue so that people can just get the contours of how the story has changed.
Right, it has. And as a normal disclaimer, there's nobody that I know of who in any way, shape, or form agrees, supports, or accepts or condones the treatment of any group of people like that which was dealt out to Europeans, Jews. It is hideous, unforgivable, unforgettable, but so was the treatment given to those in Cambodia, 3 million who were slaughtered. So was the treatment given to the 50 to 60 million that Stalin slaughtered in the 30s and 40s and 50s and even on after he died. So were so many other groups who were destroyed, the Armenians at the hands of the Turks in 1917. 1 to 2 million there. I am an equal opportunity mourner, okay? And what I, as a journalist, ask is the simple, honest question of what really happened. Let's find out what really happened. It seems like it's not asking too much, is it? Well, it is in some circles.
It's completely right and proper to remember and memorialize the victims of genocide, war, and oppression throughout history. But what's wrong is to selectively highlight one group of victims and to ignore or downplay others.
Degrade them. It's an absolute blasphemy on their memory to ignore and dismiss the slaughter, the genocide of hundreds of millions of other people throughout history. It's wrong.
So that's why enacting a law to protect legally or to prohibit any dispute of the so-called official story with regard to one victim,
right,
without similar laws,
right,
for other victims is obviously a one-sided special status given to one group of people.
Correct. Now look what happened with the United Nations. Rather than do the right thing and mourn all victims of all Holocausts, they opted to support just one. What kind of message does that send to people whose relatives died in the Armenian massacre, in Pol Pot's massacre in Cambodia? What kind of message does that send to the world? What kind of a body is the United Nations? A human life is a human life. And until we get to a point of advancement on this planet, we're never going to make it. It's real simple. We've got to mature as a species. We're not there yet. Hopefully enough of you good people will stand firm long enough that we'll demand it and we'll get it. Back in just a minute with Mark Weber. With Mark Weber. All right, so where does the Ernst Zundel trial stand right now, Mark? What's next?
So the last word was that the trial will probably be resumed no earlier than February or March in the new year.
So Ernst Zundel loses 4 more months of his life.
Right, that's right.
At least.
And remember, for those who may not have been following the case, Ernst Zundel lost 2 years of his life in solitary confinement in Canada on a bogus claim that he was a threat to national security. 2 years of his life in solitary confinement. Luckily, his conditions are more humane in Germany now than they were when he was in Canada, but he is, if anyone is, a victim, a thought criminal, a man who is a victim of an oppressive law that would be considered unjust and outrageous under any other circumstance. You know, it's interesting. Just the other day, there was a lengthy piece in the Los Angeles Times here by a writer named Guttenplan, who was trying to defend these laws in Europe. And it's remarkable because there's been very little coverage, actually, in the Los Angeles Times about the Irving arrest, but mm-hmm. the article telling readers how they ought to think about the arrest was much lengthier than the actual report. But that's typical, and when you see that, yeah. by the way, in newspapers, you should be very suspicious when we're told how to think more in greater detail than what it is we're even supposed to think about. But anyway, in this article, Guttenplan tried to defend these laws by saying, Holocaust denial causes real pain to survivors and their families. To fail to acknowledge that pain or to treat it as a particularly Jewish problem that need not trouble anyone else is to deny our common humanity. Well, this is just one-sided nonsense. There's all sorts of disputes that offend a lot of people. In our country, as you mentioned earlier, we're free to discuss various aspects of the Armenian genocide and what happened to the Armenians during World War I at the hands of the Turks. And many Armenians are very offended that the Turkish government plays down, or at least doesn't play up the mistreatment of the Armenians in the way that Armenians feel, and they feel very acutely. And this is even further back in history, of course, than World War II. It's completely legal in European countries and in our country to support communism, or even to say good things about Lenin or Stalin or so forth. That's considered completely permissible, as offensive as that is to many people whose relatives perished at the hands of the Soviet regime, and so on and so forth. But for someone to try to defend these oppressive laws on the basis that some people might be offended because of the remarks that are made about the Holocaust is completely one-sided and ridiculous. The standard of any measure, of any law, to see if it's really just, is to see how would it apply if it was in another circumstance or another situation. If that same principle can be applied across the board, then it's a just principle. But if the principle is applied selectively, then it's not a form of justice, it's a form of injustice.
I agree. Perfectly stated. What is the courtroom atmosphere like? I understand there are many supporters there, some who have come from quite a long distance. And I would suspect, although I have no way to validate this, Mark, that there is an awful lot of support for Ernst Zundel throughout much of Europe. I do believe this.
Well, one of the most remarkable features is that the largest single demonstration on behalf of Ernst Zundel to have taken place so far was in Prague, in the Czech Republic. It's even larger than some of the smaller demonstrations in Germany. Now, Germany is a country where the situation is more oppressive. Yes, the courtroom has been packed overwhelmingly with people who support Ernst Zundel, and there's been quite a bit of media attention. Now, the media attention in the German media, in the German press, tends to be very hostile. But nonetheless, the defense team has been putting up a very spirited defense on behalf of Ernst Zundel, and they are not going to back down. And that has already just made a lot of people in Germany and in Europe stand up and take notice. The David Irving case, if it comes to trial, will even be more dramatic. Now, there's some question about what will happen there, because the Austrians may think and calculate that a full-scale trial in Austria may be more harmful than helpful. Remember, unlike the Ernst Zundel case or the Germar Rudolf case, David Irving is not a citizen of the country in which he's being prosecuted, and the so-called crime is quite a lot more in the past. But the mood is, by Ernst himself and by the defense team, is very upbeat, because they feel that the law under which he's, and the specifics under which he's being prosecuted and indicted here, are so outrageous that they have a good chance to win, at least in the arena of public opinion, if not before the court itself. I mean, one of the most dramatic and important aspects of the indictment brief in this particular case is that the very first charge is that Ernst Zundel broke the law because material disputing the Holocaust story appears on the website in the United States. That's a very outrageous aspect of it, because what's being prosecuted is legal in the country where it's being said.
Of course. This is madness. It's insanity is what it is. It's insane. It is not sanity.
To try to enforce such laws would bring international chaos. It would make, in effect, expressions of opinion illegal in all, well, anywhere. In other words, a criminalization of an expression of opinion in China could be enforced here in the United States, for example. That's just crazy. Or Saudi Arabia or Israel or so forth. And the doors to that would just be, it would open the door to just a completely chaotic and ridiculous situation. Now, on that basis alone, the defense team is very optimistic that they can at least make this case, make these points very strongly in the court of public opinion once the trial really begins.
It's all amazing. The whole idea of imprisoning or threatening to imprison someone for thinking or saying something that simply has a different take on a piece of history is, I don't know where to go with this, Mark, because it's so off the charts, it's over the top, off the scale, it's like we live in the Middle Ages again. Well, this is not something of a modern culture. This is something of a medieval, dark, sick, degenerative culture that is imploding upon itself.
I think that even those people who defend these bizarre laws and this oppression of free speech feel very uncomfortable about it. And one of the expressions of that disquiet is the fact that we see very, very little about these laws and what they mean in actual practice in the American press. The American media has reported almost nothing about the nature of these laws and the fact that many people have been victimized by these oppressive laws.
Correct. All right, stand by. We'll continue in just a couple minutes with Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review. Okay, back with Mark Weber, trying to get a handle on the future of Ernst Zundel. Now, the trial, March? How pathetic. Oh, truly pathetic. All right, what do you see as the... I wonder if the people who have forced this issue and who are behind the arrest of and pending deportation of Rudolph and who knows how many others are getting to the point where the backlash is going to give them second thoughts, and maybe this could end up in some kind of a dismissal with a fine, and Ernst is turned loose at some point, 3.5 years of his life gone, having to pay a fine, and they just want to kind of sweep it under the rug. If the backlash is strong enough, that could happen. Could it not?
It could happen, Jeff. In previous cases, individuals who have been punished under these laws have sometimes gotten relatively short sentences because they don't want to make an example out of
it. What about credit for time served? Huh?
Well, presumably German law would not give Ernst Zundel credit time for
in Canada. Oh, man.
Now, however, in the Zundel case is particularly difficult because Ernst Zundel is so well known and so prominent for his publication of newsletters, books, and what's appeared on his website with regard to this issue. If Ernst Zundel is let off or let off just with a slap on the wrist, that would almost open the door to just making the law a mockery. So the German authorities are between a rock and a hard place on this one.
Huh.
It's really part of a larger political battle that's being fought in Europe. It's whether Europe is going to really be European, or whether it's going to be subject to special interest laws that uh-huh. are not at all protected of a really European right, but are special laws that protect the rights and interests of a different minority, of a different group. That's really uh-huh. what's at stake here.
Uh-huh.
And it's really a part of a larger battle for the soul of Europe and the soul of the West, or even of the world. The effort by Israel and by other groups to impose these laws around the world was given a big boost just the other week when the United Nations passed this resolution in the Security Council, in the General Assembly, which also condemned denial of the Holocaust in whole or in part. That was the mm-hmm. wording of the resolution.
Wow.
And the implication mm-hmm. of that is mm-hmm. that those laws, these laws similar to these, mm-hmm. ought to be enacted and introduced everywhere in the world. Not just Holocaust denial, as they put it, in whole, but in part. Well, what does that in part mean? Does that mean any disputing of numbers below 6 million becomes a crime? Well, it opens another door here as well. Now, many people, I think, who listen, and in general in the public, in general in the world, might think, well, what difference does it make, really, whether we memorialize victims of the Holocaust or not? I mean, look, it's a long time ago. Nobody's really hurt. We just say, well, you know, of course, we should remember the Holocaust. That's understandable. But behind these resolutions and behind these laws are really questions of power and politics. And there's a great deal you'll find on our website, and we've talked about it at times in the past, Jeff, about how the Holocaust story in our society has come to play not merely a cultural but also a political role, even a financial role in our society. One of the most interesting books on this subject that's available is called The Holocaust Industry by Norman Finkelstein. And it's a remarkable book. In fact, because the author of this book is himself Jewish and the son of Holocaust survivors,
mm-hmm.
the book was able to be published and distributed, and even was a best-selling book in Europe
mm-hmm.
in a way that a book written by a German or a Frenchman or so forth mm-hmm. would not have been possible.
Mm-hmm.
But the book, Norman Finkelstein, is particularly outraged at the way in which very large organizations like the World Jewish Congress have blackmailed, extorted billions of dollars from companies and from corporations and from whole countries.
Countries, yeah.
Very little of this ever going actually to survivors or victims of the Holocaust. Instead, they go to Israel, they go to lawyers, and they go to expand the coffers of already very wealthy Jewish organizations such as the World Jewish Congress.
Right. Did you see the story the other day about, and it was dated about a year ago, and I didn't see anything after its initial release, that a lot of money was in Israeli banks put there by Holocaust survivors who had died.
Right.
And left no apparent immediate heirs. In the meantime, the banks were making billions, ultimately, maybe hundreds of millions, on that money. And not giving any of it back to the families who had put it there.
Yes. Now, it's normal that when a bank account has money, when a bank has money from someone who dies and no one knows who the heirs are, it goes to the bank. Or in America, it usually goes ultimately to the state. That's
mm-hmm.
how that happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason this story is so important is that some years ago, the World Jewish Congress, backed by the United States government, blackmailed Switzerland and Swiss banks into turning over billions of dollars to the World Jewish Congress and to
right.
Jewish organizations on the basis that accounts of Jews who died in World War II reverted then to the bank. Okay, well, that's the kind of normal procedure. But what was left out at the time is that this didn't happen merely in Switzerland. It also happened in banks which at that time were in Palestine, are now Israeli banks. The very same thing happened, but no one is pressing those banks for restitution or for to make up for this in the way that was Switzerland was so fervently pressed by the World Jewish Congress to turn over money.
Right.
That's why it's such a big issue, because there's a double standard involved. And, by the way, the same pressure has not been put on American banks, but they have been put on Swiss banks.
Round and around it goes.
Well, it's not just money that way, too. It's also the Holocaust campaign is meant to enforce this notion that, well, one of the lessons is you should support Jewish interests, you should support the State of Israel. Jewish leaders over and over, including Ariel Sharon just recently, stressed the lesson for the Holocaust is a strong Israel is important, and that translates into policy. And what does a strong Israel mean? Well, it means supporting policies which may be contrary, which I think are contrary, in fact, to the interests not only of our country, but of much of the world, much less of Arabs, but using the Holocaust or using the memories of any group of people who died in the past to translate into policy now is a very dangerous thing.
And I agree.
It's especially dangerous when this translates into support for a country which has thumbed its nose at many United Nations Security Council resolutions, which is the only country in the Middle East with a nuclear arsenal, which is the only country in the Middle East which occupies the land of any of its neighbors, and is in this constant strife and turmoil with its neighbors, which drags Americans also into this same conflict.
I agree. Okay, how do we know about the health of Ernst Zundel? How is he doing?
By all accounts, people who are in the courtroom, lawyers, and so forth, he's in better spirits and better health than he has been in quite a while. Now, of course, he doesn't want to be in jail, doesn't want to be in prison, but the letters he's written to me and to others over and over stress that he's a lot more upbeat, optimistic, feels better than he did when he was in Canada.
Can they actually pull this so-called trial off without allowing evidence in his behalf to be presented? How revolting would that be for Europeans and Germans?
Right, that's right. Well, this has happened before in Europe. Similar trials have had the same results, in which the prosecutor or the judge is simply the judge is simply forbidden the defense to present evidence to show that what Ernst did has some justification, has some validity. There's some reason. Now, they can perhaps argue that the law itself. And I don't know what the judge's view about this is, because we haven't seen some of the internal arguments yet. The judge may or may not permit a defense argument that says that the indictment itself is improper and illegal because Germany has no jurisdiction over a website in a foreign country. That ought to be point one right off
course,
the bat.
Of course, agreed.
And, for reasons we've talked about earlier.
Okay, so we have to wait now until after the holidays, until after the new year?
But you're more likely to read about what happened in the David Irving case, because that case has actually gotten more attention in the world media, because Irving is better known around the world. Now, again, you and I have followed the Ernst Zundel case, but it hasn't gotten as much attention in the American media.
Sure.
It's gotten attention in the German and Canadian media, because that's where he has lived. But the American press has been very, very quiet about the Ernst Zundel ordeal. But there has been more about the treatment of David Irving.
What do we know about the procedures of trial and accusation and charges and defense in Austria?
All I know, and this is just based on the press reports, is that he was charged on the basis of something said 16 years ago at a talk in Austria.
Will he be allowed to defend himself in Austria?
Allowed to defend himself, but again, truth is no defense. Remember, David Irving was fined 10,000 marks in Germany, and then the fine was increased because of a statement he made that was true. He declared at a talk in Munich that the so-called gas chamber shown for years to tourists at the Auschwitz I main camp is a post-war dummy reconstruction. And that statement is not only true, Irving attempted to call as a defense witness on his behalf, the curator of the Auschwitz State Museum, Franciszek Pieper. That petition was denied by the court, and it didn't matter to the court that what Irving had actually said was true. And so Again, I don't know the specifics of what he said supposedly 16 years ago in Austria. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this may, again, cause more trouble for the Austrian authorities.
Well, all right, Mark, thank you very much for the report and the update. We'll be here and watching it with you.
You're welcome, Jeff, and it's always a pleasure to help you and your listeners in this regard.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Mark Weber, the director of the Institute for Historical Review. As we continue to report to you the Ernst Zundel trial, now we may be seeing news, maybe on a broader scope, about the David Irving trial in Austria. These are weird times we live in, and they're dangerous times too, friends. We'll be back in 21 hours. Until then, we'll see you at Rents.com.